you start to notice the sense of calm. And the sense of calm comes from several areas. One is because you're able to change the relationship with the thoughts in your mind. So in the past, you would think a stressful thought like, oh no, I'm going to be late. And then it would start to spiral into, oh no, I'm going to be in trouble. And then I'll have to move this meeting and blah, 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 blah. And then the stress starts to mount as a result of the thoughts. And with meditation, you learn to not engage in those thoughts. The thoughts are just thoughts. They're just stories. You can learn to let it pass and not follow the thought train. You can get off the thought train.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass, these are the themes we are exploring. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. Well, speaking of business, badass, and inner balance, today's guest has it all. Ariel Garten is a neuroscientist, an innovator, a mother, and an entrepreneur whose driving purpose is to empower and help others overcome mental obstacles in order to live healthy, happy lives and help them reach their maximum potential. Ariel is the founder of Interaxon. They are the makers of the Muse meditation headband, and they are a Canadian company. Muse is an award-winning wearable technology that assists and trains meditation and mindfulness. Muse takes the guesswork out of meditation. It's used by thousands of people daily with over 5 million meditation sessions to date. Ariel was an incredible guest. Not only was she articulate and understanding of the ecosystem of entrepreneurship, but she was incredibly insightful as to the tools that we have available to us to help us accelerate our capacity to think, gain clarity, and have big picture thoughts as it pertains to entrepreneurism. What made her so perfect for the Anthropology Podcast is we digress from these big picture ideas to then look at what it means to be a mother, what it means to have balance. How do we throw all of these things into the melting pot and still continue to create incredible businesses and solutions in the world? This was one of my absolute favorite podcasts. I know you're all going to love it. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce you to Canadian innovator, entrepreneur, Ariel Garten. Ariel Garten, welcome to the Anthropology Podcast.
Thank you, Megan. It's a total honor to be here today.
I'm really excited to get into this interview and to chat with you a little bit more about meditation and the Muse. You know, you're a founder, a mother, a neuroscientist, the chief evangelism officer for Interaxon, the company that produces the Muse. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey as an entrepreneur and what the Muse is all about?
Sure. So in terms of my entrepreneurial journey, I think like many entrepreneurs, I was born an entrepreneur. My dad was in real estate. My mom was an artist. So everybody around me just worked for themselves. And that seemed like the most natural and logical thing to do. And I learned from my mom that you could just imagine something and make it come to life. She made these big paintings on a canvas. So my whole life, I was imagining what the world needed or how the world could be better and going out and doing it. I started to become very interested in neuroscience towards the end of my teenage years. In the meantime, I was a fashion designer. I had a line of clothing that I sold to stores around New York. And I was also loved science. I excelled at science, and I was very fascinated by the brain and what it could bring to us, how we could understand the world by understanding our own brains. So we started to collaborate with this professor, Dr. Steve Mann. He was the inventor of the wearable computer. And we started to create concerts where you could literally make music with your mind. He had an early EEG, brain-computer interface system. And we would take the sounds that came from people's head and translate it into music. And from there, I said, oh, my God, we're like literally controlling the world with our mind. And the world needs to know about this. So I formed a startup. I brought together my good friends, Chris and Trevor. We got together in Trevor's basement regularly. And we kind of said, OK, well, what can we do with this amazing technology? How can we let people understand the power of their mind? We ended up doing a massive project at the Olympics where people in Vancouver could control the lights on the CN Tower, Canadian Prompt and Niagara Falls from across the country with their brain. We're like, what's the biggest thing we can do? We know the CN Tower. How about the Olympics? Amazing. And yeah, totally amazing. And we went forward. We pitched the idea. We got the contract and created something that had never existed before. And then we sort of stood back and said, okay, well, controlling the lights on big buildings with your brain is phenomenal, but not very useful. Not a great product market fit. Not going to really move the needle for the world in any real way. What's the best way we can take this technology and actually apply it to our own human lives to really help people every day? And that's where meditation became the obvious answer. So we were able to take this amazing technology and apply it to this ancient art of meditation, where you sit and you meditate and you wonder what goes on inside your brain. And with Muse, we could actually show you what goes on in your brain. It can give you real-time feedback, so you can literally hear the sound of your mind while you meditate.
Did you meditate before this?
So prior to this, I was a neuroscientist and a psychotherapist, amongst the million other things. So I was very knowledgeable on meditation. I would recommend it to my patients. I would attempt to do it myself, but never did it very well. I was one of those people who would sit there and my brain would bounce all over the place and I'd be like, oh my God, this is just not for me. And so it was through the process of building Muse that I was able to actually build a tool that I could use to teach myself to meditate and to build a practice and do it regularly.
Okay, so what is the Muse? I mean, I have one, but what is it for those who are like, what is she talking about? And then how does it work?
Sure. So the Muse, for anyone who doesn't already have one, it's a brain sensing headband that helps you meditate. It's a clinical grade EEG, the same thing they use in hospitals, and it tracks your brain during meditation and actually lets you hear what goes on inside your mind. So the metaphor we use is your mind is like the weather. So when you're thinking, distracting, worried, your brain's bouncing all over the place, you actually hear it as stormy. And as you come to clear, focused attention, it quiets the storm and the winds. So you can actually know when your brain is wandering and when you're in focused attention, and it guides you to that focused place. And then there's a motivational architecture with it. So there's scores and graphs and charts and feedback. So you can actually see what your brain was doing during every moment of your meditation. You can track your meditation, and it has motivational architecture to encourage you to keep going and meditating day after day.
Yeah, I remember the first time I used it, full confession, it made me so angry because I actually thought, I'm like, okay, I know how to still my mind. Somehow I felt like you have a degree in naturopathic medicine and you inherently can have this capacity. And I put it on and I just couldn't get past not just a little bit of weather, but like raging category 6 hurricanes on the other side of the app. And I was like, come on. Like, I feel like I'm doing what I always do when I meditate, which made me realize I was never meditating. I was fully engaged in like category 6 hurricanes at all times. And it was so neat to really to just like keep practicing and having that biofeedback. It was like having a trainer, because if you don't have someone who just like, you know, puts your hand on your lower back, as it were, at the gym, and is like, oh, you know what, just shift your pelvis this way, and now you actually will have the exercise work, I would still be sitting alone, bored, in a state of hurricane anxiety, thinking that I was doing the right thing. Like, it was really a powerful transition for me, which I'm sure is a story you hear all the time.
Yeah, and thank you very much for sharing that story. A lot of people think that meditation is something different than what it actually is. So people are like, okay, I'm sitting here and my brain's going blank, so I'm meditating, right? And we built Muse to help solve that problem, to actually show you what, and it's just one technique we use, focused attention, to show you what you're doing in a focused attention meditation, and to teach you to actually focus your attention on your breath, notice when your mind wanders, and bring it back, to go through that practice and to really sit there and hold your hand and act as a coach and a guide inside your own brain, letting you know when you're wandering and how to bring it back.
And do you find that when you are talking to people or they're using their muse over a period of time, is the goal really that they reach a point where they don't use it anymore? Or do you find people are consistently using it as part of their practice? Like, how are people leveraging it long term?
So it shifts. So for people who've never had a practice before and muse is the thing that teaches them how to meditate, we like to think about it as training wheels. So muse teaches you how to meditate. It gets you on the road to a practice. And then we want you to be meditating at times without muse, because the goal of meditation is to not have this device you use all the time. The goal of meditation is to have a practice that you carry with you everywhere in you, which you do with you, you know, you do all the time naturally. And so you start to sort of go into the world and start meditating without muse, and then you come back to muse as a way to anchor and to keep you moving forward and to continue to press you forward. For people who already have an existing practice, they'll use muse as a reflection of their mind and for the first time actually see what they're doing while they're meditating. And, you know, some people will consistently use muse with every meditation practice for the first 10 minutes to get them into a very quick calm state and then do a different meditation. So once you have muse for a while, you start to play around with it. There's ways to adjust all of the sounds so you can use it to track your meditation without giving you the real-time feedback. There's lots of different ways to play.
I will say that something that I've been playing around with actually in my office is hooking people up to HRVs while they're hooked up to their muse. Which is really interesting. And the other thing that I've been doing is I actually use the muse when we put acupuncture needles in people.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And really, and what we find is that people get a longer standing effect from acupuncture when we can have them connected to the muse at the same time, which is actually just a really neat clinical tool to be able to use it that way. I'm not sure what it does to their meditation, but I know from an acupuncture perspective, it changes the outcomes that we're seeing, which is actually really neat.
That's amazing. So the protocol is they lie on the table, they put on a muse, and they're musing simultaneously while you're doing the acupuncture.
Correct.
And what do you observe as the outcome?
Yeah. So what I actually find, because I'll often ask people to really focus on what they're feeling around the needles. Mm-hmm. And everyone has a different way of describing it, but I will often describe it as it almost feels like there's a ball around the base of the needle. But different people have different language that they use. And I find that when I have patients who will do it without the muse, but then we'll have them do it with the muse, that they have a greater capacity to actually describe what they're feeling around the needles. And I can come in as well and I can put my hands over the needles, or we can like engage energetically that way. And they're much more tuned in and tapped in to knowing when I'm doing that than when they were, you know, are just lying there or their mind's been wandering or they're thinking about getting back to work. I've just found it to be a really neat tool to be able to combine the two together.
That's fantastic. So for them, it's really acting as a cue to keep them into a meditative state, to remind them, nope, we're doing work, you know, stick with the program, stick with me here.
Absolutely. And then it means
awesome.
We don't necessarily need to do acupuncture as frequently, because I think they're getting a stronger benefit from the experience.
You have to imagine that this is totally fascinating for me to hear. I mean, you and I have never met before. I don't know how you use it in your practice. And, you know, we created this tool that we hoped would help people and that we hoped they would use in their life and would move them forward every day. And to hear from a practitioner that it's something that you use in practice to facilitate your trade, to help other people, you know, kind of, you know, multiple fold, is just phenomenal. It is such an honor and so delightful. So thank you.
Yeah, such a pleasure. Well, thank you. And you know, meditation is something that I find is so, it's so provocative for people, in that I have some people, and I'll mention mindfulness and meditation, I can literally watch from their body language that this is an area that they are really not interested in exploring, likely because of their own preconceived ideas around what it's going to be like. And then I have other people, you say meditation, mindfulness, and they are like, they're so excited to start to go there because their life has been profoundly changed by it. And I always say to people, there's like a line in the sand of the meditators and the non-meditators. Until you throw the non-meditators into that meditative state, they're like, nope. And then once people cross the line, I don't feel like they ever go back. So like, what's the deal? Does meditation really change people's lives that profoundly?
So if you do it, and that's a big caveat, you actually have to do it regularly to see the benefit. The answer tends to be yes. Like, people, when they start to meditate, see significant changes, and it happens across multiple facets of your life, or it can happen if it works for you. So one of the first things that you begin to notice is that your attention improves. So in a focused attention practice, what you're doing is you're focusing on your breath, your mind wanders, you notice that it's wandered and you bring it back. And so one of the first things I noticed was I could get to through a long format document much faster. So in the past, I'd sit in an open office and people would walk past me, they'd distract me, I'd be hungry, and it would take me forever to actually get through something long that really required thinking. And now after using Muse and meditating for the first little while, I was just able to get through it quickly because I understood this relationship between distraction and choosing where to bring my attention. So that's the sort of like, you know, practical. Then you start to notice the sense of calm. And the sense of calm comes from several areas. One is because you're able to change the relationship with the thoughts in your mind. So in the past, you would think a stressful thought like, oh, no, I'm going to be late. And then it would start to spiral into, oh, no, I'm going to be in trouble. And then I'll have to move this meeting and blah, 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 blah. And then the stress starts to mount as a result of the thoughts. And with meditation, you learn to not engage in those thoughts. The thoughts are just thoughts. They're just stories. You can learn to let it pass and not follow the thought train. You can get off the thought train. And so you don't feel the physiological reaction that comes from it. And then you recognize the same thing actually can happen with your emotions, which is an even more complex notion. So we feel all these sensations throughout the day, which we call emotions, and which we like label and give a lot of weight to. Oh, no, I lost this deal. I feel really disappointed. And then you feel the heaviness of the emotion, then the thoughts that are triggered from it. You know, oh, no, what does this mean about me? Maybe I'm not good enough, and, which, you know, changes the emotion again. And what you recognize with meditation is you can also get off the emotional roller coaster. So you're off the thought train, you're off the emotional roller coaster, and all of a sudden, like, the weight starts to lift. You feel light and free and able to have space between yourself and your reactions. There's one other amazing thing about meditation. Meditation trains the skill of mindfulness. And so in mindfulness, you start to become aware of all of the things in your world around you. And I was speaking to a neuroscientist friend of mine, David Eagleman, and we were talking about the process of becoming aware of the world around you. And he's a time researcher, amongst other things. And in the research that he's done, he demonstrates that it actually makes time feel slower. So with meditation and mindfulness, you start to get the sensation of savoring every moment and savoring every day as you're aware in your world. And like, that's the sensation that I think once you really get it, like, makes this phenomenal. It literally adds a brightness to your life. It adds a sensation of savor, of time for you, of space. It's just like the world becomes brighter.
Which is so intriguing to me. And I'm sitting here as you're talking, and every time you'd mention a new point, I'm like, yes, please, yes, please. So is it the amount of time we put in every day that is going to enable us to get to these points? Is it the consistency with which we engage in meditation, or both? Because I know most people are sitting there, they're like, okay, I'm intrigued. I don't have an hour a day to meditate. So how much time do we need to put into this?
So obviously the more time you put in, the better it gets, but you don't need to put in a ton of time. So we did an early study using Muse with Baycrest Hospital, and there they looked at average subjects musing for 10 minutes a day over 6 weeks. And there with just 10 minutes a day, they saw an improvement in people's self-reported symptoms, so less headache, pain, nausea. Their own perception of their pain shifted and their perception of their own symptoms. They saw an increase in calm, obviously. And then they also saw an increase in cognitive function, specifically on the Stroop task. So in the Stroop task, you are shown a word, which is the word of a color, let's say red, and you're shown it in a different color, blue. So when you say the word, see the word red, and it's in the color red, you respond really quickly. What color is it red? Well, the people who mused for 6 weeks for 10 minutes a day could say that it was red 20 milliseconds faster. And when red showed up in blue, the people could say that, well, the color of that is blue, and they could say it 50 milliseconds faster. So your ability to make decisions around difficult things and stressful situations with conflicting information appears to improve based on the study. And then we had an Italian group of scientists recently publish their own study using Muse for 10 minutes to 20 minutes a day. So the first week, 10, second week, probably 12, 15, 17, and then the fourth week, 20 minutes. And there they showed the Stroop task effect again. And they showed actually persistent changes in people's EEGs, demonstrating that they were spending more time, even when they weren't meditating, in an alpha rhythm, which is a brain state associated with relaxed and relaxation and focus. And they also were able to see some characteristics of their brain features change, demonstrating that they're potentially processing information more efficiently. So, looks like 10 minutes a day is a pretty good starting point. But again, the more you do it, the more you learn about it, the more you really think about what you're learning and how it applies to your life, the more you're going to get out of it.
And probably the more you're going to want to do it.
Yes.
How has meditation changed how you operate as an entrepreneur?
In so many ways, I can't tell you.
Please tell us.
Yes, yes, yes. So I've always been a pretty plucky entrepreneur. I've been very lucky, and I was born with a very optimistic disposition, so I didn't have a ton of thoughts that this isn't possible. As you move in the world and you learn more and you sort of, you know, actually learn from experience rather than this blissful, beautiful ignorance of course I can do anything. You start to really get a sense of what works and what doesn't work. And meditation is something that allows me to maintain a really open perspective to what can work. And so anytime I would think like, oh no, that's a terrible idea, or like the fear would come up, that's when the skills that I've learned in meditation come in really effectively. I notice it around the office. You know, sometimes you get shy and you don't want to talk to people. You're sort of afraid of engaging, even sometimes with the people in your own office if there's somebody new. And what creates a positive office culture is being open and warm and receptive and, you know, engaging to everybody. And meditation really helps you build that skill of keeping yourself open so that you can be there and open and engaging and receptive and positive for your staff and to support those people who are around you and people you meet. Of course, the like, you know, productivity benefits have been huge. Remembering myself in high school, the level of procrastination that came out of perfectionism anxiety. So it's like, I can't write that essay because it's not going to be good enough because the teacher thinks I'm great already. And so then I can't do it. I'm not going to be good enough. You know, that cycle that many of us female perfectionists are aware of led to so much like latent procrastination because you're just afraid of not doing something well enough. And so you don't do it. And meditation really took me to like 360 on that and to understand like, you know, it is good enough. It's fine. We're good. And to also just overcome the discomfort around that like anxiety sense of like, oh no, what if they're not going to like me? What if they're not going to like it? Like with meditation, you can learn to get rid of the thoughts and the feelings associated with that and drop the stories because they're all just stories. And then actually notice that that is just a procrastination. You're just distracting and like keep choosing. Like even if this is uncomfortable, I'm just going to come back to what I'm doing. Even if this is uncomfortable, I'm going to come back to what I'm doing and get it done.
Yeah, I like that. And I feel like that is a dialogue I have with myself daily. So to that point, because you just mentioned in there in passing this concept that I feel like I talk to with my patients or with other entrepreneurs, and that is this notion of perfectionism, which I tend to see more with women than men. But, you know, to that point, not necessarily the perfectionism side, but do men and women, do you see benefits from meditation or from the use of the muse differently between genders?
I don't think so. And I certainly don't have a large enough sample size to notice. I mean, and it's so hard because anecdotally, you want to say, okay, well, with women, you're dealing with a lot more with self-acceptance, with emotion, with perfectionism. You know, with men, maybe it's a performance anxiety that shows up in a different direction. But honestly, all of that is just my own projection of what a gender role is. And I don't really know. I don't really have the data.
Yeah. And it might just be a gender projection of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Which is well common said. To both. Yeah. And so the other population that, you know, as you're talking and my kids have certainly been intrigued by my muse.
Awesome.
Right. And so can kids use it, or am I concerned about like Wi-Fi or different things on their brain, or yeah, can kids go there?
Sure. So we have lots of people who muse with their kids and their kids love it. It's a great way to get your child into a meditation practice. The band we say fits from about 13 and up, but depending on the size of your kid's forehead, you know, people have fitted on significantly younger children. And if you put a little bit of water on the sensors, even if it isn't touching perfectly, it can create a little bit of a bridge between their forehead and the sensor.
Oh,
so just put water on the ear, contacts and on the forehead sensors. And kids get it. And then they get really excited about it. And like people always tell me stories about their kids musing. And they'll be like, you know, my child was thinking of fluffy bunnies. And they, and you know, and every time she thought of a fluffy bunny, she would relax. And so you learn lots of great lessons for how kids intuitively manage their own mind and try to get themselves into different states.
Yeah, it's actually, it's super interesting. And I agree with you. They were so excited when they were hearing the birds. And I didn't have to explain to them how to do that. They just knew. And they're little, like they were like 4 and 6 at the time, playing with this. And they kind of looked at me like, why are you still hearing your category 4 hurricane? And we're having no problem with that. It was really interesting. It was definitely an interesting experience and conversation, and such a great reminder that I think sometimes we try to think about self-development when really we kind of actually need to remember we have all of these skills. And you made reference to this earlier that, you know, you don't need to necessarily have your muse on at all times. The idea is that this practice is within you and available to you at a moment's notice, which
absolutely.
I like.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's such an easy skill to teach to your children. My kid's a little bit too young. He's 2. But we work on just breathing. You know, if he wants something really badly and he's getting all fussed up, just like breathe 3 deep breaths. And that's sort of, that's our go-to, 3 deep breaths, and then we can move on to the thing that you want.
Yeah, and I think as we're aged, we're always, as we get older, we're always so surprised at the way the stress can kind of hijack where we're at. And such, it's such a neat skill to be able to teach young people, for sure. So go ahead.
I was going to say, and such a great skill to have as a mother.
Yes.
So, I mean, as a mother, as you go into motherhood, you're like, this is going to be amazing. It's going to be sunshine and roses. And then you're like, oh my God, I feel kind of stuck here and we need to do the same thing every day. And I'm not entirely sure like who I am anymore. And having a tool set that helps you manage your mind and manage time and manage space inside you becomes so key. And it's very easy for people to, once they become a mother, just, you know, be there with their child and be so used to doing something else that your brain starts to create that activity for you. So you're so used to, you know, being busy on your computer, doing all these things in life that you can no longer do because you've chosen to be there with your child, that your brain starts to actually generate a whole lot of garbage content just to try to keep it busy in the way it used to be used to. And so meditation then becomes a key skill to be like, nope, all of that internal dialogue that's trying to generate something else for me, I don't need you right now. I'm choosing to be here with my child. I'm choosing to be present for my child. And when you do that, like it, the world quiets and you're actually there in those beautiful, you know, Hallmark type moments with your kid.
Yeah, it's such a great point. And I know for a while, so we've been under renovations this year and we've moved a lot, and it wasn't a time period that was really conducive for me sitting and meditating in the morning. And so what I opted to do instead was, when I'm with my kids, to just be fully present, to hear them, see them, watch them, like not be on my phone. And certainly there's days where that doesn't happen. But it was interesting. I had a very similar experience as I would as if I had an active and ongoing meditation practice, because kids really force you to be focused, and they call you out when you're not.
Oh, yeah.
they're like your own personal version of the muse.
Yes. And so you were lucky you had the experience of meditating before that to then be able to be with your child and say, no, I choose to be with them now, and know how to do that. But I recognize through conversation with a lot of mothers that it's not a skill that everybody has when they come into motherhood. And so, you know, you're supposed to be there with your child, but it becomes really difficult because it can become really hard to turn off the dialogue in your head, particularly when you have a whole new class of things you need to do now, and the groceries and the this and the preparation. And so it's so easy to live not in the present with your children, even though, you know, we have this glorious image of being with your children. That's what it's supposed to be. So for all moms out there who are like, I don't live in the present, don't worry about it. Don't be hard on yourself. It's okay. But there are, you know, easy tricks to start to engage just being there and letting everything else drop away.
Yeah. And to be totally clear, I am not in like a state of blissful parental presence. most of the time. Like, it requires this, like, coming to whatever moment where I'm like, okay, like, it's now out of control. You're just going to be fully present for the next 20 minutes and let everything else go. Because this is hard. This is a hard phase of life. And there's so many different pressures coming at you. How are you finding balancing being an entrepreneur and running a growing and expanding and innovative company and being a mother at the same time?
So I took the choice to spend more time with my child once I had him. So prior to this, I'm now 39, 38 years old. I don't even know how old I am. I'm 38 years old. And so I had a child relatively late in life. So I had the opportunity to spend all of my time prior really devoted to the startup and nurturing it, feeding it, growing it. It was the baby. And it took about 7 years of growth. We're now at about 65 people, product shipping internationally in 5 languages. And when I became pregnant, it was like, okay, well, now is the time when I can actually choose to step down as CEO. I am no longer going to be the CEO of my own company. I'm going to let somebody else run it. And I'm going to choose to take the space to be with my family. And, you know, people were sort of surprised by that choice. They're like, don't you want to be Marissa Mayer and do it all? And my answer was like, no, I truly don't. I do not want to have a crib in my corner, in the corner of my office. That's not a badge of honor. I want to choose to take the time to be with my child and, you know, figure out how I can still make it work economically, but make as many choices as I can to be with my kid during this period. So it's now operating quite, you know, the business runs on its own. There's somebody else who runs it. I get to, you know, help and support it in a million ways that I love, but really protect the time when I'm with my child.
Do you think being a parent has made you a better entrepreneur?
Absolutely. You know, my mom told me before I had children that when she had children, she didn't realize just how capable she could be. Because all of a sudden you have this thing that you do every day, and now you have to do the same thing and have one or two children on top of it. And, you know, with every child, that sense of your own capability and, you know, what you can do expands. It's like, you know, the muscle and the space grows, like your heart grows and your capacity also grows. And it may feel like at moments it's all completely out of control and you have no idea what's going on, but your capacity has significantly grown for what you can do.
Yeah, and you're right. It is completely out of control at times, but that's okay.
Like, and it's totally okay. Yes.
Yeah, it's part of the journey, and it's part of the intensity of this phase of life. What would you say to other women who are like, okay, I have big entrepreneurial dreams. I am trying to balance it out with kids. Like, what were some of the things that you did? And you were in a fortunate position in that you had built so much of your company. But what are some of the things and decisions that you have made that you're like, I made the decision not to show up for work. For me, I don't show up for meetings before 9:30 in the morning because I don't want to rush them. I have that control and that flexibility. And so I exercise that. And that makes a huge difference for me. But do you have some things like that that you have chosen to do that have enabled you to have a greater sense of balance?
Absolutely. So I protect from 6 to 8 p.m. You know, I get home by 6, the child goes to bed at 8, and 6 to 8 is my glory time. And that is 100% for me and him. And I choose to let other things slide during that period. You know, do we make the greatest dinners? Am I the most brilliant chef? No. And that's because I started to notice when I was putting more into making amazing dinners, and yes, everything's still, you know, healthy and fresh and balanced, but it's like I'm cooking single ingredients and serving them. I'm not making things that are elaborate. And because when I was cooking, I was taking time away from being with him. And it's like, you know what? It's not worth it. We can have fresh peas and they'll be delicious, but they don't need to also be in the pasta with the cream sauce. It's fine. So really making the choices and what I choose to do so I'm not overachieving, but choosing to be with him. And I'll make the choices to do what he wants to do and to spend the time with him rather than trying to fit him into my schedule. So it's like, you know, like, we really need to go out to dinner at this place now and rush to get there. It's like, well, that's not what he feels like doing, and it's not what's going to make the best interaction of our time. You know, the best interaction of our time is probably sitting on the floor playing or sitting in the backyard. So let's just eat something delicious out of the fridge and sit in the backyard with something maybe half cooked and just be spending the time together rather than trying to rush and get this somewhere or be something or do something big.
And has that shift in needing to not be overachieving at all times, is that a combination of meditation and life experience and just confidence, chaos? Like, how did that transition happen? Because I do feel like it's just a really important place for female entrepreneurs in particular to be able to find.
Okay, so you notice the amount of laughter that I have now. Mm-hmm. I can't even answer because I'm laughing so much. Yeah, the word overachieving like hit the nail on the head. My mom and I used to both joke that we're card-carrying members of the Overachievers Anonymous Club. And not overachieving can feel like a really big deal and almost threatening to the self. So like we build our sense of self on, you know, who we are, what we're able to accomplish, how capable we are as women. You know, these are, you know, like big myths that we need to live up to, that we are capable women. And overachieving and the kind of social reinforcement that we get from that, the personal reinforcement, the family reinforcement, the larger social and career reinforcement we get from that, becomes part of how we value ourselves and part of what we then feel like we need to keep doing in order to maintain and improve the value of ourselves. And that can be really damaging. And it's only like, and we think it's a great thing to do and we feel like it's a great thing to do. So like, you know, even for me, it was slightly awkward on air to admit that I'm not the best chef in the world, you know, and I don't make these amazing creations right now because I'm choosing not to. So absolutely a combination of meditation, you know, the wisdom that you kept from self-reflection, age, and the value that I place on my experience in the moment, the value that I place on relationships has shifted the value that I perceive in myself from somebody who needs to overachieve to, you know, to achieve that, to somebody who can simply live and be and feel the value.
Yeah. And it's interesting listening to you talk because in my practice, I work with entrepreneurs. That's my focus. And I find that there's a transition that happens where achievement is very much associated with the external validation from the world, right? So we achieve these things and the world's like, good for you. And you do another thing and we derive a lot of satisfaction for that. It's like we ride that train. And then I feel like there's this transitional point. And it's different for everyone where you pull that train into the station. And what you realize is that the thing that got you to that point is not necessarily what's going to get you to that next point. And it's like we get on this train of self-actualization where it suddenly goes internal. And now it's about being able to put things out into the world that are deeply satisfying to you. Yeah. And there's way less concern about other people's accolades and way more about going to bed at night and being like, I kicked ass today at life, at being a parent, being an entrepreneur, doing whatever, on my terms.
Yes, 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 yes. That was so beautifully put. And the question, you know, yes, this notion of on your terms is something that's so key. And for me, you know, it was always about doing things that I wanted to see in the world, things that I wanted to see happen, you know, oh my God, we could do this thing. And like the idea that it was possible to control something with your brain, like that's possible. We can make it happen in the world. That would be amazing. And for me now, it's the mission of helping people undo the knots in their head and recognize that these negative stories that hold you back are things you can let go. And that's never going to die. Like that's a key sense of my own personal achievement. But there's a huge shift towards the sensation of being a happy and contented person in my life, building happy and contented relationships and raising a happy and contented child that has become so much more valuable because I guess I also see that as a service to the world, which the initial things were too. And so it's a shift in my perception of like, what is this act of service to the world that I'm doing? And raising a child is just such a massive act of service. It fulfills both within yourself and within, you know, kind of what you're giving to the world, such a big need that it kind of allows you to let go of this, you know, I need to overachieve in every category.
It's a great, so you just answered the question I was about to ask, which was, what do you want your legacy to be?
So it's a beautiful question too. So obviously one of my legacies will be this hopefully beautiful child. I say hopefully, like hopefully he will continue to grow and mature and flourish and live a long life. My other big legacy is exactly what I mentioned, helping people undo the knots in their head. Allowing people to recognize that the negative stories you have about yourself are not true. That we are all these amazing, beautiful, capable, phenomenal individuals. But most of the time, we don't think that is the case, and we don't feel that is the case because of the stories that we harbor about ourselves. You know, the stories of I'm not good enough, and oh shit, I shouldn't have done that, and oh, they don't like me, and like, all of these things are just crap that sort of sits in our brain and eats away at our sense of self and our sense of self-esteem. One of the saddest stats I've ever heard is that 85% of the world has low self-esteem. And if I, in some small way, can help people recognize that you don't need these stories and help provide tools to help undo the narratives and drop the inner dialogue so that you can recognize the amazing, beautiful, capable human beings you simply are, then I feel like I might have done something. So that is my legacy.
We've all heard that mindset has a huge influence on our ability to be effective and amplify in this world. But what if I told you your brain biochemistry, literally the neurotransmitters that are existing within your nervous system, can help amplify your mindset or your capacity to be effective? They can help accelerate your mission in the world. More and more with both my coaching clients and my patients, we end up having a conversation related to our own ability to control our nervous system through the optimization of neurotransmitters. Now, what the heck do I mean by this? The foods that you eat, the way that you think, your interaction with the world has the capacity to increase things like serotonin or dopamine, some of these really important neurotransmitters to helping you be effective and operate at your best. After listening to literally thousands of conversations with my clients and with my patients, I pulled together a very quick checklist so that you could have a better understanding of the things you're doing every single day to amplify your nervous system or downregulate it in a way that isn't necessarily serving your mission. If you want access to this information and want to learn a little bit more about how you can optimize your brain health for success, visit meganwalker.com/brainhealth to grab your handout now. Now, back to our episode. That is a beautiful legacy to have and a really perfect place to transition to the last part of the interview. And I call this section our KPIs or key performance indicators. So just like we would have these in our business, I believe we also have activities that we participate in our daily lives that give a really strong indication in terms of how someone lives a full and fulfilling happy life. So I've got 6 rapid fire questions for you. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready. Bring it on.
Okay. Do you have a consistent evening routine? And if so, can you share?
For sure. I already shared what it is. I get home at 6. I spend until 8 o'clock with my child. We do dinner and bedtime and laughing and all of the greatness. He goes to bed for 8:30. And then from there, I spend some time with my husband. Typically, he and I have dinner then together. We'll do a little bit of work. In the evenings, I become very, very creative. And so that's the time when I want to make something. I want to, you know, I'll have an idea and it's like, oh, I need to paint. I need to sculpt. I need to vision this thing. So that's when sort of like the creative juice starts to rise because it's just my own time. And then every night before I go to bed, I will meditate for, depends on the length of time, depends on the kind of meditation I'm doing, but typically about 20 minutes.
Fiction or nonfiction? What are you reading right now?
Currently nonfiction. I picked up Richard Feynman's Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, like the ultimate physics science nerd book about the physicist Richard Feynman. It was a book that I had read in childhood, and I was just reorganizing my like bookcase and picked it up and just delighted when I started to read it again.
Amazing. What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health? Outside of meditation.
Okay, so meditation was an obvious one because that happens every single day.
Yeah.
I do a lot of things for my health. Exercise is obviously key. At least half an hour of walking every day, you know, as a baseline. Above that, hopefully dancing, stretching, loving. And vitamins. I am a kind of nerd when it comes to supplements. So every day, my DHA fish oils and on and on and on. Probiotics, vitamin C, multivitamin, NAD+, et cetera, et cetera.
I hear you on that. What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
Totally badass about me. So I already revealed that I love to dance, and that love of dance really moves in 3 dimensions in every possible sphere. So I love to contact dance. You can like literally take me and spin me around your shoulder. I figure skate because I'm Canadian. So at one point I had a buddy who was a hockey skater and I was a figure skater, and we would do like mock little figure skating routines where he would literally like lift me up, twirl me around, put me back down, and we'd gracefully glide down the ice.
That's so Canadian. So I love it.
Yeah, so Canadian, and also I have very little fear when it comes to physical stuff.
Besides skating and dancing, what do you do for fun or play?
Obviously, there's also the kid. So fun and play these days are like imaginary games. It's whatever he's into. A lot of tow trucks and rescuing the kittens and from the... He'll put his like stuffed animals up into the apple tree in the backyard, and we have to take a little fire truck and rescue him, and I help him climb up and get it, and then he hugs the kitten, and so he's playing out these little narratives and I play along with him. It's lovely.
Love that game. And last question for you, Ariel. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
So for most entrepreneurs, we are born this way. I'm sorry, it's just in the blood. It is just, you cannot be anything else. For everybody else who feels like maybe they're not an entrepreneur and wants to be, you can absolutely learn to become one. Entrepreneurism is a learnable skill it's really just around managing your risk and being able to see a big idea and make it come to life and bring together a team. So both, because I certainly wouldn't want to exclude those who may not feel like they're entrepreneurs now, but truly are latent entrepreneurs with a skill that you can learn and go out and make whatever you want with.
Yeah, and have a passion and a message they want to share with the world. It's an amazing tool to be able to do that. Ariel, it has been a pleasure having you on the podcast today. I know people are going to want to learn more about what you are up to, and if they've made it this far, they're just waiting to find out how they get their hands on a Muse. Where can we send them?
Sure. You can go to choosemuse.com to learn more about Muse. And then you can follow me on all the socials, Ariel's Musings on Instagram, Ariel Garten on Twitter, and Ariel Garten Muse on Facebook.
Amazing. And we'll hook everyone up with links to grab themselves a Muse. Those will all be in the show notes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, we would love for you guys to share what you got out of it on our Facebook page, and also leave us a review on iTunes. It's so helpful in terms of us being able to reach more people with a message of how we make badass women incredible entrepreneurs and healthy entrepreneurs in this world. Ariel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Total honor and pleasure.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.